1st, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflo.
And I'm Pam Bedour.
We are back again with another chapter in A Study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes novel. This is chapter 10, John Ferrier Talks with the Prophet.
So guys, remember how the last chapter brought us into romance territory? And we were all, I think we could say a little underwhelmed. Or of Utah. How are you guys feeling about this story now that we've got John Ferrier and the Prophet?
I don't think this is a romance story.
Really?
It looks like there's an arrangement that's being trying to make. That's not called romance.
Yeah, I don't like this story anymore, Pam. I don't want to read this anymore.
But we're starting to get the motive. By the time we get through the end of this chapter, we're understanding, listen, there are some tensions going on. And this could lead to us back to Sherlock Holmes and what caused this murder.
And certainly murder is a dark subject. Certainly the death that we see in murder mysteries is dark. But, oh my goodness, this chapter is frightening.
Isn't it? I know. And, you know, it's funny how murder, of course, obviously you're reading a murder mystery. You know you're going to get some darkness. But this really felt dark in a completely different way than part one.
And if it was written today, it would be even darker.
No doubt.
So there's a reason why we're reading a book that was, you know, from the, you know, 1880s. And it as dark as it is, it certainly isn't as dark as they could have made it, especially today's writer would make it.
So
interesting, though. I'm not sure I completely agree with that, Chip. I know what you're saying, that we've become far more graphic.
Yes.
Descriptions of violence and especially sexualized violence. And that is pretty dark stuff, of course. But I think that there's something to be said for the understatement of Victorian fiction. We know what they're talking about here, right? And, you know, the Sherlock Holmes story with the forced marriage where the girl is drugged and there's like this fake minister. I mean, okay, so it's not spelled out, but it's still exactly as dark. It's just stated differently. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but this is cultural. This is beyond a single assault. This is a cultural statement about, hey, look at culture and what we in power could do if we had these ideas.
Right. Ugh. Okay, so going through the chapter, let's look at the chapter opening to start. This is quite a shift, remembering that we left little Lucy Ferrier as the happiest girl in all of Utah.
Well, she's going to get old Jefferson. Jefferson's coming back.
Mm-hmm. Jefferson, well, right. Hope.
We are He's advancing. So this is no longer 5-year-old. She is certainly older, but we're not quite sure how much we've gone through this story.
That's true. Is she like 13? Is she 17? We don't know. It's true. So 3 weeks had passed since Jefferson Hope and his comrades had departed from Salt Lake City. John Ferrier's heart was sore within him when he thought of the young man's return and of the impending loss of his adopted child. Yet her bright and happy face reconciled him to the arrangement that any argument could have done. He had always determined, deep down in his resolute heart, that nothing would ever induce him to allow his daughter to wed a Mormon. Such a marriage he regarded as no marriage at all, but as a shame and a disgrace. We learned a lot in that opening paragraph, don't we?
So what do we know from the last chapter? He is certainly fulfilling all his obligations as a Mormon, except for maybe something that we'll talk about in a second. But he certainly, in his heart, hasn't adopted the Mormon way.
Right. And now the last chapter, The Flower of Utah, it's third person, so you don't have an eye narrator, but it was focalized through Lucy's perspective for the most part. This one, telling us right from the start, is focalized through the perspective of John Ferrier. And I just wanted to pause and think about like a Ferrier, his name, because you know Doyle likes, you know, he likes names a lot, right? So So a farrier is a smith. So a worthy, hardworking cornerstone of a village or city. And I think that like John Farrier acts in that way in Salt Lake City. And so he's connected to both hard work and to shoeing horses. So this kind of industry plus nature. So I think that Doyle is kind of setting him up for his London readers in this very specific ways. And
yeah, he's good at that. I thought at first farrier as in a person who moves, a farrier. And and you're right. It's more about the industry, the smith of the town.
Mm-hmm. And of course, fer in French is iron. And so he's very strong. And we saw that in his resiliency when he was out in the desert too. And we can see here that Farrier is totally a father to Lucy, right? In any way that matters. Mm-hmm. And he's both pragmatic and ethical. So this is where we find out he doesn't believe that Mormon marriage, he says it's a shame and a disgrace, but he still does participate in the Mormon practices in order to get along. I mean, this is where he lives. He had the choice of death or becoming a Mormon. He chose to become a Mormon. So he kind of balances his beliefs and his like two sets of beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think again, Doyle captures that nicely.
Yeah, this is a message from Doyle again. And boy, this whole chapter becomes a message from Doyle about all of these issues.
Mm-hmm. So
he is the fine, upstanding person, and he's certainly not going to create any waves in his community, is basically what it comes out to be. But obviously he is still an outsider.
Right. And just think about the first three chapters of part two, right? We have that desert chapter where John and Lucy are almost dead, but the love between them is so powerful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then we have the Flower of Utah chapter, and then we have this super dark chapter. The contrasts are incredible, right?
Yes, this is great writing. There's no doubt this is great writing. It is affecting me in an emotional way, and that is a good sign of great writing. I don't want to read this anymore.
I'm sorry, Steve.
Steve, we only have another chapter when we go back to Sherlock Holmes' world.
Good.
That chapter is going to be pretty rough, guys. I'm sorry.
Foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing, right? Did you guys see some foreshadowing from previous chapters?
I certainly did. John Farrier didn't marry. I called it yesterday. Yep. And I said it was a signal to the reader and also the Mormons that he had integrated in the Mormon culture, but he never truly embraced it. He's having this conversation with Brigham Young, and Farrier says, and how have I neglected your society? Throwing his hands out. Have I not given to the common fund? Have I not attended at the temple? Brigham Young basically answers. He goes, where are your wives? Call them in that I may greet them. So immediately this lack of marrying somebody means he has purposely stayed an outsider.
Not just somebody. But the polygamy, the multiple wives, plural, is a cornerstone of the Mormon history.
At that time. But still, he only needed one wife. If he had just taken one, he could have justified it. He chose to take none. Basically, the person he chose to care for is the person who is ultimately is his adopted daughter.
Remember yesterday, we were talking about all the positive representations of the Mormons in chapter two.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of the representations in this chapter? I mean, they're pretty complicated, right? Very complex.
Sure. Yeah, if we look at American history, many people feel our country was founded upon religious freedom. Any group that came over could set up their community and have whatever their beliefs were at the time. And they didn't necessarily have to be open to outsiders. And certainly the Mormon feeling that they were a chosen people, they went on a pilgrimage with a Moses character, they were given a land that was certainly something that was given to them by God, and they were to live as they felt God has set out their lives. If you look at it from their point of view, this is their destiny. This is what was promised them from God. And from an outsider, it looks strange. And even maybe within the groups, there can be some dissent. But we'll learn that Quickly is ferreted out, and there is no dissent. I mean, you're as open as you keep your mouth shut and don't question things. Do you want me to go through a little bit of the history of going on around that time and kind of outlining some of that stuff?
Yeah, you are our historian for sure. So you tell us all about the history of this time, please.
Well, I was going to mention that Utah was founded in 1848 and became a state in 1896. So if we think around the time that Doyle is writing this story, yeah, there's probably some talk about Utah becoming a state. And I'm sure that Mormons in the far west is a topic that is of interest. In 1849, the Mormon leaders hosted a constitutional convention to write a constitution for the state they wanted. And they wanted to name the state Deseret. Interesting. That is used in our chapter. Before that, we need to know that there was a group called the Danites, and it was a fraternal organization founded by the Latter-day Saints in June of 1838. This is back when they were in Missouri, and they were making their pilgrimage. Ultimately, they'd been making their pilgrimage out to Utah. And it was a vigilante group. There was some, certainly every place the Mormons stopped, there was some kind of skirmish which led them to continue moving. But we need to know that there's no evidence that the Danites still exist. So it is kind of a militia.
The quote that Doyle gives us about the Danites is, "To this day, in the lonely ranches of the West, the name of the Day-Night Band, or the Avenging Angels, is a sinister and ill-omened one." These are people who will enforce their rules and enforce what their belief system is.
And think of any place in America that has some kind of outlaw vigilante group. And you can see how it could terrorize a population. We also need to know a little bit about the Utah War, the Mormon War. The Latter-day Saints Church leaders believed an isolation of Utah would secure the rights of Mormons and would ensure the free practice of their religion. During that time, we need to know that this territory that they ended up grabbing was given to the United States, or basically secured by the United States, from the Mexican-American War. So the Mexican-American War was won. The treaty was the Guadalupe Hidalgo. It was signed in 1848. At that point, the United States was given the land from basically the Rio Grande, which is basically southern Texas, and it was almost straight across New Mexico, Arizona, California, and every place north of that was given. So the land that ultimately was secured by the Mormons was the land of, you know, what would become Utah. The primary concern was they wanted to be governed by men of their own choosing rather than what we call a carpetbagger, you know, somebody sent by Washington to lead their territory. They wanted somebody of their own. They came to a compromise. The president at that time, Fillmore, selected Brigham Young, who was president of the Latter-day Saint Church, to be the governor of the territory at that time. We need to know about 25% of the people who were members of that church lived in polygamous households at the time. And numerous newspaper articles continue to sensationalize Mormon beliefs and exaggerated earlier accounts of conflicts with frontier settlers. So this was certainly something that would be written about and probably a little common knowledge, just kind of like learning something from some far off area that's a little different than what you currently are dealing with.
Yeah, this is something that Shakespeare did in his time, was talk about exotic lands and exotic peoples. And this is Doyle here going, hey, I've got a story to tell about this group that you may have heard of. Let me explain. And maybe he's using research that is exaggerated to tell this story.
And ultimately, where this comes into play is where it will lead to the American Civil War, interestingly enough, because what allowed slavery to exist in parts of the United States also allowed Mormons to exist. They used the same legal precedent or similar legal precedent to allow this group to exist. Well, that switched during that period of time. And you could see where, you know, we eventually fought in the American Civil War, But right before that, the idea that Mormons should be able to live their life as they want to switched, that they certainly were not going to be allowed to continue with some of the lifestyle choices that they had made. And you can imagine for a hardy group, a frontiers group, to have, you know, some group from out east, probably a 3 or 4 month, I don't know, horse ride to go see them is going to rule them. You can see even today how different areas interact with authority different ways. And, you know, obviously Mormons had a very strong belief system at that point. So that may be enough of a background for us.
That's really helpful, Chip. Thank you. And I'm especially thinking that, not knowing nearly as much about the history, I did notice that within Doyle's representation, he does have a sort of attempt to explain the psychology of the darker side of this group. So, like, really early in the chapter, he says, "It's a dangerous matter, so dangerous that even the most saintly dared only whisper their religious opinions with bated breath, lest something which fell from their lips might be misconstrued and bring down a swift retribution upon them. The victims of persecution had now turned persecutors on their own account, and persecutors of the most terrible description." Mm-hmm. So there's this notion that the Mormons had to flee religious persecution, and now, as sometimes happens with like victims of bullying or of violence, then they become a bully or a violent person. And so there's this sort of cultural explanation for this switch from persecuted to persecutor.
Mm-hmm. And again, this might be Doyle writing this based on very little knowledge. This might be all conjecture, but there's so many stories. There's so many stories about this time period and these wars and these fights that happened. This is really dark story.
Well, the United States was just being founded at that time. Think about this. I mean, we're talking about 120 years ago, Utah wasn't a state.
Well, and we're talking 1840s at this point. So
Sure. We're looking
100 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, Chip, I love that you mentioned that philosophical and rhetorical connection between slavery and polygamy, how these practices are both about the commodification of human bodies, right? Mm-hmm. Just reading this made me think about an article that I reference all the time in my teaching. It's from 1975, a classic article in feminist theory by Gail Rubin called "The Traffic in Women, Notes on the Political Economy of Sex." And in that article, this is where she makes the distinction between sex and gender that we don't even think about today. These things are totally separate. It was brand new in 1975. But in terms of how it relates to this story, she talks about the way that women have, in a very, very long view of human history, been trafficked within initially, you know, nomad groups, but now within the institution of marriage, that a young marriageable woman becomes a way that two families get connected, becomes basically an economic and cultural commodity that would connect two families. And certainly within this story, I think Doyle is really tapping into that feminist analysis that's not going to be written for 100 years, but he's tapping into that idea that John Ferrier will not participate in the commodification of Lucy or any other woman. He will not participate in a marriage system in which women don't have a choice, in which men sit down and make the choices. And so in this extremely sinister conversation between John Ferrier and the prophet Brigham Young, he just won't participate. Brigham Young is like, okay, listen, I understand you love your daughter very much, and we're not going to marry her off to some old geezer, okay? So don't worry about that. She's going to have a nice choice to make. We've got two options for her. She could choose Stangerson or she could choose Drever. So they're both fantastic. Wait. And
did you say Stangerson and Drever? That's like a Sherlock Holmes story.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines, Steve, it was like a Star Wars story, because it seems like there is always hope. Oh, as in Jefferson Hope. Oh!
Revolutions are built on
hope.
And Hey guys, minimize this. This is really good analysis by Doyle. So Brigham Young says to John Ferrier, and he's completely, he feels super confident. He's in Ferrier's home. He has all the power. We elders, he said, have many heifers. Must also be provided. Stangerson has a son and Drebber has a son, and either of them would gladly welcome your daughter to their house. Let her choose between them. They are young and rich and of the true faith. What say you to that? And so this is being proffered as like a good offer.
Right?
But for Ferrier and for the reader, this is solid villain territory.
Because what's the opposite? What happens if Ferrier rejects this very fair offer?
Right. So we know the Council of Four. He will not be seen again. And Lucy will nonetheless be disposed of as the elders wish.
Right. And the threat is real here. The Brigham Young makes this threat in words. He says, "It were better for you, John Ferrier," he thundered, "that you and she were now lying blanched skeletons upon the Sierra Blanco than that you should put your weak wills against the orders of the Holy Four." With a threatening gesture of his hand, he turned from the door, and Ferrier heard his heavy step scrunching along the shingly path. This is a absolute, in words, contextual threat here.
Of course it is, because at some point we're told that you've got this outlaw group going out there, you know, taking down people, you know, and if you question the faith, or do not look like you're participating enough, it sounds like they'll take you out too. So this is sort of, we will make sure that we have people who adhere to our values.
And you guys, remember at the end of yesterday's chapter, I was like, do we have to read the ending? The beautiful flower of Utah. Now, this ending is so good. I'm going to read the last couple of paragraphs because there's so much in here. So this is where, turns out Lucy was listening the whole time. And oh, don't you feel for her? She's in love with Jefferson Hope, the like cute boy who saved her from that troop of wild bulls. And now she's being talked about as a commodity and she's worried for her dad. And she's also just imagining her own future in this completely different way than she had. So John said, "To tell the truth, Lucy, it isn't the first time I have thought of leaving Utah. I don't care about knuckling under to any man, as these folks do to their darn prophet. I'm a freeborn American, and it's all new to me. Guess I'm too old to learn." "But they won't let us leave," his daughter objected. "Wait till Jefferson comes, and we'll soon manage that. In the meantime, don't you fret yourself, my dearie, and don't get your eyes swelled up, else he'll be walking into me when he sees you. There's nothing to be afeared about, and there's no danger at all." John Ferrier uttered these consoling remarks in a very confident tone, but she could not help observing that he paid unusual care to the fastening of the doors that night, and that he carefully cleaned and loaded the rusty old shotgun which hung upon the wall of his bedroom. The end. Whew, lot going on here, right?
No kidding. Now, for a person who was found, he doesn't feel safe. They, in many ways, I mean, certainly in his eyes and in his family's eyes, he's been betrayed.
So we're going to get back to a murder mystery in Sherlock Holmes here, right? Right?
Anderson and Drebber, it's all going to happen, you guys.
What do we have here? Is this a love triangle between Jefferson Hope and Stangerson and Drebber, all fighting for the affections of Lucy Ferrier? Is that what the mystery is?
I don't know how you have a love triangle when she loves only one of them.
So is this something much more malicious that we're seeing here?
Cultural
assassins taking out this Jefferson Hope 40 years later? Yikes.
One thing that I think is really interesting about the chapter ending is that John Ferrier, he's a big, strong guy. He's powerful within the community. However, obviously he cannot stand up to the elders. He sends a message to Jefferson, "Come back right away." He feels like with Jefferson Hope by his side, he could protect his daughter. So that's interesting too. that he doesn't have the right network within the Mormon community to protect his daughter's future. He needs help from outside.
But it's really important to note here that Jefferson Hope is considered a Gentile, a non-Mormon.
So
he's not going to be accepted as with the Mormons.
Correct. Right. Which is what John Ferrier was like, oh, it's so hard to see my little girl grow up and marry, but at least she's not marrying a Mormon. She's marrying a Gentile. Mm-hmm. And then, so connections to part one, we've got those three characters. We've got Jefferson Hope, the Stangerson family, so young Stangerson, and the Drever family, young Drever. Now, I also paused, and I've read this novel before, I do not remember, but there's a moment in this story where John Ferrier made no answer, but he played nervously with his riding whip. And that reminded me that in part one, Sherlock asked Constable John Rance if the murderer had a whip in his hand. I have no idea if they're connected, but I paused there. So let's keep an eye on that.
Maybe. Definitely seems like something that Doyle would put in as the right? mystery writer that he is. The mystery is going to be solved and there are going to be clues. He's already told us that he's given us all the clues.
Right.
Come on, reader.
I don't know what to do about Utah
and all about everything. I've given you all the clues. What do you want from me?
Maybe we'll be in as enlightened as Sherlock Holmes is, right?
So I imagine that once we read the next chapter, which is the fourth of the American chapters, the three of us tomorrow will know exactly what has happened and we'll just go back and have Sherlock Holmes confirm that for us, right?
I hope so. I hope it'll be a happy ending. They all live happily ever after, right, Pam?
Oh, sweetie, we already know they're dead. But sure, I like that.
Well, just remember, Steve, Empire Strikes Back was pretty dark before the Return of the Jedi. So anyway, it's going to get dark, then it's going to get light.
No, light, I think it was light, and now it's getting dark. But okay, sure.
Come on, Pam, help me out here.
It's going to get even darker.
So hopefully everybody out there is still with us. Hopefully you are engaged in this story, whether or not you enjoy it as much as some of us don't. But maybe you're at least engaged and hoping for the best like I am. Or maybe you're really enjoying the history of all this stuff. Maybe this is something that you hadn't read about before. This is Doyle giving us a lot of interesting backstory, and I look forward sort of to the next chapter where we get some resolution in chapter 11 in A Study in Scarlet. Make sure you are sharing your ideas with us. Send us our voicemail, send us an email, follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes. Don't look at the news because, oh boy, it's not better out there. Come back tomorrow and we'll make it better. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflo.
And I'm Pam Fedora.
It'll be fine. So we don't talk about what I want to talk about.